Hello and welcome to the Many Rules of Film Club. My name is Jeff Yance. I am the program director at the Loft Cinema, and I am joined today, as always, by occasional filmmaker Heather Lattis.
Hi, Jeff.
And multimedia artist Rusty Boulay Stevenson.
Hey, Jeff.
So, Rusty and Heather, I think it's safe to say that we are all fans of Joss Whedon.
Definitely.
Oh, yes. Oh,
the
my.
The world of Joss Whedon. So, those not familiar, let's fill them in. The creator of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the creator of Firefly and Serenity, director of the last two Avengers films.
Has written many an episode of a TV show you probably have seen. Old Roseanne episodes.
Yes.
He had Dollhouse series.
Dollhouse.
Wrote the first Toy Story.
Yeah.
Yes.
He's multifaceted.
Also has, I don't know how many different comic book series he's made, but a
yes.
bunch.
Yeah, that's true.
A right. bunch of comic even, books yeah. that he's made.
Right. I didn't know there was Buffy comic books. I was like, what?
Season 8.
I must go look.
Yes. And that was real groundbreaking that he continued the Buffy TV series as a graphic novel. You know,
yeah.
I think it was two
amazing.
Seasons, season 8 and season 9 as
yeah,
graphic
that's right.
novels, which is great. So he did not let a cancellation slow him down.
No. And in fact, if you read what was season 8, I haven't read season 9, but gosh, season 8, he takes it in really groundbreaking ways. It would have been interesting to see how he could have done it with a TV series, maybe. But I don't know that you could make it without making it animated. I don't know that you could do what he did in season 8 that he did in the right. in the comics, because he makes who's giant in it. Somebody's a giant.
Oh, really?
Oh, that's right.
Somebody gets turned into a giant.
Giant. Yes. Tough to do on television
without
or
a
television.
Big CGI budget.
Yes. Exactly.
Yeah.
On the CW, kind of difficult to do on there.
And there are hundreds of Slayers.
Oh,
yes.
Really? Oh,
yeah. Hundreds of
I
Slayers. Yes.
These. That's cool.
Yeah, so it would have been really hard to do as a TV series, but as a comic book, and I'm not the biggest comic or graphic novel fan. I do read occasionally some good ones, and I went out of my way to read the Buffy one, and it's good. It's really very, very entertaining.
It's very good. Well, let's talk about Buffy. So I think
sure.
we're excited
Let
about
us
Buffy.
Do that.
So we love Buffy. So, I think the place to start would be, okay, the controversial, much maligned feature film, Buffy the Vampire Slayer from 1992,
True.
Which Joss Whedon wrote. It was his original concept. And funnily enough, I love the fact that he sold the original script to Dolly Parton's production company, Sand
Dollar.
Oh,
that's interesting.
So we have... Like
oh,
most,
that's why it's... Okay, gotcha.
Like most good things of the 20th century, we have Dolly Parton to thank.
Thank the Lord for Dolly Parton.
For Buffy the Vampire Slayer. So Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the movie, again, I will reiterate, it is much maligned, and I'm not advocating that it is an undiscovered masterpiece by a long shot. But I will say that I think it is unfairly maligned when... looked at in the context of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the universe. I think taken on its own terms, it's a funny teen horror comedy in the vein of Clueless.
Yeah, agreed.
It really represents the name Buffy the Vampire Slayer. It's campy the way you think that name
yes.
kind of conjures something that's campy sounding.
Yes.
And so the movie is more like that than the TV series.
But you see the thread of Joss Whedon all through it. It's about, well, here we have Christy Swanson, who is perhaps maybe not the greatest casting choice.
No.
To play Buffy the Vampire Slayer. She goes from being what she calls a mall doll, as in someone who hangs out at the shopping mall, a very vapid, self-involved. She becomes very strong, empowered. She becomes the hero. She ends up saving the guy played by 90210's Luke Perry, mm-hmm. who he basically plays the damsel in distress in the film,
yeah.
and she's the hero, which is very Joss Whedon.
Yes. I like that part.
Yeah. But Joss Whedon has openly said that he feels like the movie was pretty much mangled by 20th Century Fox. It wasn't his original vision that made it to the screen. But I'm going to advocate checking it out if you've ignored it because you know that Joss Whedon doesn't like it.
It's worth a watch.
Look at this
it
cast.
Is.
Rutger Hauer, Donald Sutherland, and Paul Rubens, Pee-wee Herman, as a vampire.
Yeah.
That alone should get you to watch it.
Yes.
But again, making no claims that it's a great film. But it did pave the way for Buffy the Vampire
and
Slayer.
And it made money, which that's good for Joss Whedon.
It made money.
Because it did allow him then to turn that into something else.
Yes.
It cost about $7 million and made $16 million. So that's a pretty good profit that you turn.
Yeah.
For
yeah.
a movie called Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Yes. And I think, you know, important that it was directed by a woman. Well, so it was yes. a big, fairly big budget studio film about a female hero directed by a woman.
Yes.
And again,
true.
That's very Joss Whedon, you know, like wanting to support women in the industry. And then in 97, of course, was the launch of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the TV show. On, by the way, the WB.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when that, I saw the first episode and I thought, well, surely this can't be that good. This is the home of Charmed, which was the big show, I think the big WB
yeah,
show at the time,
true.
About the three witches. I thought it was going to be more in the vein of the movie. And I was very wrong.
So you started watching it right away.
I started watching it right away. I was into the, because I had enjoyed the feature film. And I thought, well, this is going to be an interesting project for television. And immediately from the first episode, I was hooked. I realized this is something very different.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny, it's campy, but it's also got depth. Even in the premiere episode, you could tell this was being set up as something very unusual.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I didn't start watching it till... So, 97 was the middle of my college years. So, I did not start watching it till season 3.
Mm.
And
yeah,
then
that's
I was
when
like,
I started.
Hey, what's going on? I need to go back. Because season 3 is the senior year.
Yeah.
Going into college year. And so, right when the Hellmouth is going to...
Oh, yes.
...come to head. And I honestly didn't... I probably didn't start because I was a little bit put off that it was called Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Wasn't... biggest fan of the movie, and it was on the WB. So I think that's probably why I didn't start. But then I started watching. I was like, what is this? And why haven't I watched it? Mm-hmm. Why did it take me so long? And then now I've watched all of it.
Well, yeah, I remember reading reviews of it. And I mean, I avoided it because it was called Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I just did. Mm. I was kind of snobby about what I would watch and what I would read. And then I read all these great reviews. So I started watching it in season 3 and I couldn't believe it. I was stunned by how good it was. There's such great subtext in every episode. It works as metaphor. It's got this strong female lead who's super badass and kicks all these vampires' asses. And just so much of it was so good. And then I would tell my friends, I'm like, you guys have got to watch Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Mm-hmm. And people would laugh at me.
Yeah, people, whenever I mention it, they're like, really? You like Buffy? Like, I love Buffy. What are you talking about?
And I think at this point, there's no guilt. Involved.
It encompasses everything a woman would want in a TV show. She kicks ass. She's got a moral code. They're hot guys and hot ladies. There's everything and demons and vampires. It's, I mean, what
and
more
all the
you
feeling
want?
And all the thought,
emotion, layers.
Yeah, and it's got a lot of philosophy. It's got a lot of ideas involved. There have been a number of books written about the philosophy of Buffy the Vampire
Buffy
Slayer.
Buffy studies. It's in college courses
There's Buffy
now.
Buffy studies.
Yeah.
There's someone has made this claim. I'm not sure this is true, but that Buffy the Vampire Slayer is the most written about pop culture text of the last several decades.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised.
And I would buy it.
Yeah, I totally believe that.
Yeah.
Well, and I would point out too, I look at three episodes in particular that are some of the best television that's ever been made. There's the silent episode Hush, which totally harkens back to silent movies. Right. There are demons who take away everybody's voice.
Right.
And so a whole silent episode, and it's brilliant.
I mean, who would have you now if you pitched that as a TV show episode? Mm-hmm. They would laugh at you.
Oh, even then, I bet they had to. Oh. Except that he was on this roll of making this amazing stuff.
Yeah.
Once more with feeling, there's a demon that comes and makes everybody sing everything. That episode is hilarious.
It is
so good.
Yes, that's a great episode. Even if you don't know the show,
yeah,
you should watch that episode.
Mm-hmm.
That episode alone
is a great standalone.
Yep, it is. And then there's the probably the best episode, which is The Body.
Right.
Which is about, spoiler alert, but Buffy's mom dies. Mm. And so it gets you to care about this character, this really peripheral character, Buffy Summers' mom, And it's so brilliantly written. Every time I watch it, I cry. It's one of the best television shows I think I've ever seen. I can't think of a better one that I like. Yeah. That's, I think, is stronger.
It's very powerful. Yeah. And I think the Buffy the Vampire Slayer show really plays up, I think, something that Joss Whedon is so great at, is making women the center of the action, where they're, I think, particularly in genre, horror, sci-fi genre, women don't often get to take the lead.
No, they die.
They die, or they support the men doing the job that the men are doing.
Well, they're not part of the story that makes it move along.
And here Buffy has her, she called it the Scooby Gang, so she had her posse of friends who sort of helped support what she was doing. Because she had to save the world. That was her job.
Yeah.
Which is kind of the most important job of all jobs.
Well, and it treats these topics that are otherworldly, like this idea of a vampire slayer, and brings humanity to it. Because often Buffy is questioning, like, why is she chosen to do this when she just wants to be a normal teenager? You know, like, normal teenagers stay at home and watch movies or hang out with their friends, but she has to go kill vampires at night, you know, go on patrol. And, you know, so I think adding that layer of humanness and reality to a sci-fi, you know, storyline, Joss Whedon does that so well.
And it was a love triangle, juicy love triangle. Is it Buffy? Is it Buffy and Angel? Is it Buffy and Spike? So I think that also attracted you, if you just wanted to watch it on a surface level as a soap opera, because it kind of worked on that level too.
Well, and the idea that if she and Angel have sex for the first time, Angel will have a happy moment and he'll get his soul taken away. And the idea of, you know, a young girl having sex for the first time, turning the guy, it's very interesting, like subtext is so great in that. It's amazing.
Yeah. And I think also we discussed a little while ago off mic about existentialism. So to me, Buffy the Vampire Slayer is one of the most existential texts, like pop culture texts, that I've ever seen. Again, a little bit of a spoiler alert, but not really. So Buffy dies.
Yeah.
In the show, she's brought back to life, but very reluctantly, and she questions why she's even alive for a whole season, basically.
Yeah, season six, she's questioning her own existence.
Right, like, what is the point of coming back to life?
Right, I do the same thing all the time. I fight demons and...
Right, and nothing ever really changes. And that, to me, was such a grappling with such a huge concept in this kind of pop culture, like, kind of wacky, you know, horror context, that I realized at that point that this was actually a really important kind of major cultural kind of landmark, because I think it got people talking and thinking about really big ideas.
Yeah.
Oh, I think it definitely does. And she references it in the episode Once More with Feeling. She's singing about how despondent she feels and how she's just going through the motions, I think is the name of the song.
Right. Yeah.
It's really a great song and it's a great moment and really shows you just the depth of that television show. Mm-hmm. And in researching about Joss Whedon, I've watched some interviews with him and I've read a lot about him. And he cites one of my favorite novels, Jean-Paul Sartre's Nausea, as his most influential work. And so existentialism is, I mean, that's the existential book. It obviously plays, it's a big theme in most of his work. Yeah. You see it in Firefly quite a bit. And he says that Nausea is the last episode of Firefly, the last episode of the first season is called Objects in Space. And he says it's based on the book Nausea, which I watched it last night. It's a really fascinating watch and a really amazing series as well. And you see, I think Joss Whedon struggling with that as a writer, even in the Buffy series, with what he's doing. Because in my opinion, and I don't know this for fact, but when she dies at the end of season five, I think in Joss Whedon's mind, that was the end of the series. Right. And they brought it back because it was successful and because people loved it. By that point, people are starting to recognize this is an amazing thing that he's making.
Yes.
And so they bring it back, and you can see it in the writing, just that Joss Whedon's a little bit maybe depressed about where he is and that he's still doing this series against maybe what he thought, even though we would have missed out on some amazing episodes of Buffy if it doesn't continue.
I think he was having an existential crisis.
Yes.
At that point. What is the point of continuing this when I basically killed the main character?
Right.
Yeah.
And I've ended it where I want to end it. What is the point?
Yeah.
And so I think he was wrestling with that right up to the end of the show.
Yeah, I told you guys, but the season six of Buffy, and a lot of when I was watching Buffy the first time, I really love reading Shakespeare and I love all the different adaptations. But as I was watching Buffy, I realized that the creator of Buffy had to be a big Shakespeare fan because there are all these shades of gray and just a lot of moral issues that come up in Shakespeare as well. But season six reminds me a lot of Hamlet in that I a lot of times when I read Hamlet, I think that Shakespeare may have been depressed when he was writing it. It comes from a very dark place. And I wonder if he wasn't questioning his own existence. And I see that with Joss Whedon and season six of Buffy, particularly the first half of season six. It feels like the writer might be depressed and certainly wondering what he's doing.
Right.
Right. Dealing with that existential dilemma of how am I spending my time? How am I spending my life?
Yeah.
And isn't that amazing for a TV show called Buffy the Vampire Slayer? Like,
who would have guessed?
Yeah.
With a title like that.
Yeah.
I think also it's interesting to talk about the casting in Joss Whedon's oeuvre in general. So I think the casting of Buffy is so important to the success of the show. I mean, yeah. Sarah Michelle Gellar, I can't really imagine a lot of other young actresses from that era being able to pull that off.
Definitely not.
So effectively. And she grows so much, both as a character, as an actress.
Yeah.
Which I find interesting. She becomes a better actress as the show goes along, I think. And he uses, you know, a lot of actors over and over again, like Nathan Fillion pops up in a lot of Whedon product.
Giles, whatever his name is.
Giles. David Boreanaz.
Yeah.
Was in the Angel spinoff, of course. But I think that also speaks to Joss Whedon sort of being a respected figure in the industry, that these actors want to keep working with him again. They like what he does for them as actors because they're great roles.
Yeah. I also think, I don't know this, but Joss Whedon is very steeped in film. His dad was a writer for TV shows. His grandfather was a writer for TV shows. So I also think some of these people, Nathan Fillion maybe in particular, I think they're friends. It seems like they probably hang out, even judging from what I can see.
Right.
Joss Whedon made a Much Ado About Nothing, Much Ado About Nothing. Mm-hmm. Nathan Fillion's in that. And it was all shot in Joss Whedon's home that his wife designed and over the course of 11 days. And it feels like a party, that movie.
Oh, very much so.
And so I could see that maybe he's friends with lots of these people.
Oh, I'm sure. That was like a labor of love, if I recall.
He did it instead of go on vacation.
Yeah.
He made Much Ado About Nothing.
The other actors were doing it as a labor of love to him.
Exactly.
And because they respected him so much.
Yeah. Which I think is also maybe the impetus behind Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog, which also feels like sort of a labor of love, kind of like a wacky sort of one-off kind of thing.
Oh my gosh, I love that.
And it's great. And Neil Patrick Harris and Nathan Fillion are both in that.
Yeah. Captain Hammer and Dr. Horrible.
And also great tunes, actually great music.
Yeah, Joss Whedon co-wrote the music with his brother and sister-in-law. Mm. And the music's great in it. His brother also did the score for Much Ado About Nothing, and Joss Whedon wrote the songs that are in Much Ado About Nothing. So music really plays a huge part in what he does. And evidently, he is a crazy dancer. Everybody says when he goes out dancing that he outdances everyone and does it all night long.
Like Elaine from Seinfeld dancing, like crazy?
No. Just like loves good, doing like just it. He's crazy, a good dancer and loves doing it. Just it sounds like the guy likes to have a good time, and music obviously matters to him a great deal in his life. Yeah. You can tell.
Yeah. So that was also very, I think, forward thinking, Dr. Horrible, because it was internet only.
Yeah, it was one of the first kind of series that happened that was on Hulu. It was a big thing. I remember you mentioned it was during the writer's strike, which made sense in my head once you said that.
Well, and you can see the production values aren't the best for it.
Right, exactly.
There are lots of scenes that are overexposed and not really well shot. It's a really great storytelling. It's a lot of the music will remind you of Kurt Vile or Stephen Sondheim. Mm-hmm. It's really steeped in this great Broadway tradition of great music from musicals.
Right.
And it's a really fun story. It's neat to me, and it's Joss Whedon. It's a testament to how great he is as a writer that these, like, it's a one-off Dr. Horrible sing-along blog, but all the characters feel completely developed, fully developed. There isn't a character in it that feels flat, really. Everybody has backstory. Everybody has a story going forward. And there are lots of things. The female character in it dies, the love interest of Dr. Horrible. And I'm not sure, like, when I watch it now, I've watched it. I bet I've watched that thing 80 times. When I watch it now, I often think that maybe that wasn't really her character, that maybe she's also a villain as well.
Right.
She says some stuff that's kind of got these dark undertones that make you think that maybe she's a secret villain herself. And so I wonder if that wasn't a robot. That would totally be in Joss Whedon's wheelhouse to have the character that died be a robot.
Well, and he claims a sequel is coming, but he's been claiming that for a long time.
Yeah.
So maybe we will find out.
Oh, I would love the
question mark.
Yeah, she's got to be in it. You couldn't have Penny not be in it.
Right, exactly.
So that's why I think she's a robot or it was a clone or something. And I'm pretty sure she's an evil character. She says some stuff that I love her line. She says, "Well, everything happens." He's like, "Don't say everything happens for a reason." She's like, "No, I wasn't going to say that. I was just saying everything happens.
Period. Yeah.
And that's not exactly what a hero would say.
No,
you know, that's
no.
That goes against the grain of a lot. Yeah. So,
well, and I think one great thing about Joss Whedon is the ability to create fan communities. I think Firefly and its spinoff Serenity, which is kind of, I guess, the season two, technically, of Firefly.
But a full-length feature movie.
A full-length feature film. So that was great, too, that Firefly was canceled for low ratings. And then he went and did this big-budget feature film. And that was amazing.
Yeah.
So he doesn't really, like when Buffy, like he just kept going and continued it as a comic book. He seems to be very resilient, wanting to keep these stories going, and he'll find ways to do it, even if the industry doesn't allow him the opportunity. Although now, of course, he's a big deal, so I think he can do anything he wants.
He can do anything he wants as long as he finds the time to do it.
Yeah. But, you know, Firefly Serenity has its own fan base called the Browncoats, you know, who are very passionate and do a lot of social philanthropy work. And Joss Whedon started Equality Now, this organization for equal rights for women. And so they host yearly screenings of Serenity to raise money for Equality Now. And he supports that every year. So he actually, one other thing I like about him is that he puts his money where his mouth is. So he creates these texts, but he also is doing real world action.
Yeah.
And obviously equality is very important to him. And so that's, you know, what he spends his time doing.
Yeah, no, I think that's really cool. And in our last episode, we talked about Stephen King. Stephen King's another person who does that, who really puts his money and he's motivated politically to do stuff. And I like that about both of these gentlemen. But Joss Whedon does it, in a really neat way and in a way that is empowering to women. And there's a quote, and I won't get it exactly right, but somebody asked him, "Why are you always making these strong female, why does it always have to be about these strong female characters?" He's like, "Well, it has to be that way because you're still asking that question."
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right.
Stop asking. Start doing.
When I don't have to answer that, when that's not a question anymore, that's when I don't have to do it anymore. But as it is, that's something he feels really strongly about.
Yeah. And we also talked about this off mic, but I was also a big fan of the show Roseanne.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where he got his start. As a writer on television, was writing episodes of Roseanne in the early seasons. And I clearly remembered episodes of that show that felt, you could tell they were a little different. And then looking back, those were Joss Whedon written episodes.
Right.
And the episodes he wrote were about the young girls on the show sort of finding their voice and their power. So he was doing that from the very, very beginning in a context you wouldn't expect on a sitcom, an ABC television sitcom. Starring Roseanne.
No, forward thinking.
It was a very forward thinking show.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
In a lot of ways. But his whole career has been that trajectory. And most recently, of course, the Avengers. So now he's working for Marvel, although he has claimed that he will no longer work for Marvel, which I find interesting. So what do we think about the Avengers? He's done two Avengers films.
Well, I actually made this comment last night that I really, having refreshed my memory on Buffy, I feel like he didn't do his best with the Avengers, and maybe that's too harsh, but I feel like he's so good at character building, even when the characters are not big on the in the storyline, and maybe there's just too much going on, and he needed to stick to the Marvel timeline, Marvel universe, but I don't think he had a chance to really do his Josh Whedon thing. And there are moments, there's like little gems, like if you I think Hawkeye and Black Widow especially, you can see Josh Whedon in them, even in a little bit of the Hulk, little bit.
Yeah, I was going to say the Hulk. Yeah. His dialogue,
yeah,
I totally.
Yeah, you can see that. And then in the Avengers Age of Ultron, when the Russian superheroes, I cannot remember their name, but the one played by the Olsen. Anyways, if you've seen it, you know what I'm talking about. Yes. That felt very Josh Whedon, that storyline. And so there's definitely some markers of him in the Avengers. So the Marvel universe didn't take all of it away from him. But I think, you know, I think that's the problem of comic book movies now, is that there's so much action and so much going on and so much must follow this timeline or rules that they're not able to develop those stories and character backgrounds like Josh Whedon would normally do.
Yeah, and I think he did as good a job as anyone could do to put their voice into a Marvel movie.
Yeah, there's still the pop culture references, and a lot of his dialogue is really unique to Joss Whedon. In Buffy, there's the joke about, like, culty, putting a Y on the end of everything.
Right?
Like, that really started with Buffy and is now up. It's permeates our...
You put a Y on everything.
Yeah, you put a Y on everything now, right? Yeah. And I also see it in... especially in Firefly, because he's created this universe that's in the future. And so there are just... There are cool... It's got some Chinese in it, it seems like, that he uses as part of the dialogue. But he also has, they call the universe the verse. They call, you know, where they live the verse. And it really works well. There's a character in the last episode that says, you know, this isn't my final act in the verse. And that just works in so many ways. It works a verse as a story, verse in a song, universe, you know, I'm going to continue to live.
Right.
And Joss Whedon, I mean, he hits that so far out of the park with that kind of thing, where his pop culture references and his use of language. And that's again where I bring up Shakespeare again, because Shakespeare did that too, where he made these phrases that are now part of our culture. Joss Whedon does that too.
Yeah, very verbose. And that struck me from the first episode of Buffy. Like, these kids, these high school kids, are not talking like the high school kids that I know.
No.
Right.
So they were very wise beyond their years, which made it a very interesting kind of tension, these really profound things and articulate things coming out of the mouths of these high school kids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you took, like, what you would call the stereotypes. Even Cordelia, who is one of the most annoying characters he has ever created.
Yes.
He gives her depth in a way that you wouldn't expect a sitcom or a 1-hour TV show to do.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, and he has said that, so now he's done with making Marvel movies because he feels like he's gotten away from creating his own universes, and he wants to get back to that, which I think is going to be a great thing for pop culture.
In general, yeah.
Yeah. And I think we should also just touch on The Cabin in the Woods. So that's a horror film that he produced and co-wrote, maybe 2012.
Horror comedy.
Horror comedy. But I think he was very intent on sort of reinventing the genre, because it's a very twisty postmodern horror film that's about horror films. And it's interesting. People that I know who like horror films that I discuss this with love it or hate it. Some people can't stand it because it's a constant pulling the rug out from under you kind of film.
Yeah, it is.
There's a lot of trickery, misdirection, fake outs. But I think it's really a fascinating film.
It is. It is a fascinating film. It kind of... it kind of becomes its own worst enemy as it goes on, right? I like it. I would say I'm in the camp that likes it. I maybe don't love it. There are moments I certainly love. And if you're a Joss Whedon fan, there are lots of character interactions that are really funny.
Right.
If you know his universes. But it does tend to, because of all the pulling the rug out from under the audience all the time, ultimately that kind of detracts from it.
Yeah,
I think by the end.
It's so clever. I would say it crawls up its own backside.
Yeah.
And then comes out through its own mouth and becomes something else. And you may not like the final product, but it maybe stops working as a horror film at a certain point and it becomes something else. It's a comment on horror films.
It's a comment on horror for sure. I mean, that's what it's doing.
Yeah.
It does kind of climb into itself and regurgitate itself back out.
What a great metaphor we're using here.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Well, it's an interesting movie. It's not like much else that I've seen.
No.
It really is poking fun at the horror genre while still reveling in it and still loving all of it. So,
and I think that's what he did with Buffy. Like, he sort of reinvented... That was a riff on horror films, too, and also teen movies. And,
sure.
So I think he's constantly looking to reinvent popular culture, which makes him, I think, important for the culture to keep moving it forward. So he needs to go off and do something. We don't know what it's going to be.
I'm hoping he doesn't have anything listed on his IMDb, I don't think. So I'm hoping he is writing and doing some Joss Whedon stuff.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to another Dr. Horrible for sure. I'd love to see more Shakespeare from him, too. I'd love to see how he does some of the meteor as opposed to Much Ado About Nothing, which is really fun. But I mean, the title alone tells you that it's not the meatiest of stories.
Exactly. Yeah. And where he got his start also was as a script doctor. So uncredited, doing little rewrites of movies like Twister in the 90s. And I find that a fascinating project, trying to look at the movies that he did script doctoring on and see where his voice pops through. And I'll be darned, you can see it. You can see it.
Yeah.
You can hear it. You can hear the dialogue. You can hear the smart kind of intellectual dialogue. So I'm curious if he would, maybe he's too far beyond that at this point in his career. I think he probably would not be a script doctor.
Yeah, probably not a script doctor.
No, but I think
people ask him.
helping other people make better movies.
Boy, wouldn't that be nice?
Yes.
I think everyone should ask him for help.
Hollywood needs that.
So we're putting the call out to Joss Whedon here on the Mini Rules of Film Club. Go out and help people make better movies. And then you make some movies.
And write better dialogue.
Help them write better dialogue for sure.
Teach a class.
You know what? How about if Joss Whedon goes help Stephen King write really good dialogue and subtext?
Then they would be unstoppable.
They would be like this super force.
Yes. Plot, character, dialogue, it's all coming together.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, what a future that's going to be. So we'll see how that pans out. Well, thank you, Heather and Rusty. That was great. Please check us out here on Mini Rules of Film Club on Facebook, on iTunes. Check our website, theminirulesoffilmclub.com. Give us your suggestions. Give us your feedback.
Yeah, we'd love to know what you'd like to hear.
Yeah. We're pretty impervious to criticism. We take it.
Oh, we take criticism and we take suggestions for sure. We've had great films that lost money was a listener suggestion.
Well, there you go. We're very responsive. Next time on Mini Rules of Film Club, we're going to be looking at rule number 932, which is sometimes the good old days were not always so good, as we look at the science fiction films of the 1950s and looking at what was really behind those. There was a lot of real stuff going on in those films, and we're going to look at that. Next time on the Mini Rules of Film Club. So thanks for Rusty. Thanks, Heather. This is Jeff Yant signing off, and we'll see you next time on the Mini Rules of Film Club.